Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is John Burns. John is the CEO of John Burns Real Estate Consulting Firm, located in Irvine. And I think maybe the best way to describe what he does is just to read what they say they do. We are a national source of independent housing research, advice, and consulting. Our mission is to help executives make informed housing industry decisions. Our firm provides builders, developers, banks, lenders, investors, and building product manufacturers with timely analysis. They need to make smart decisions quickly and cost effectively. Our research is backed by detailed data as well as proprietary tools and experienced professionals around the country. John, welcome to our show.
Thanks, Bruce.
And thanks for providing actually a very valuable service to an industry. And I guess my first question, I think you've had product expansion. Because originally, when I first heard of you, I really thought your client was strictly builders and developers. And how did that morph into other clients?
Well, I thought builders and developers needed it most, actually. So I started there, and they're not passionate about monitoring the market, but it's usually what either makes them filthy rich or bankrupt. So I saw a role I could play there, and I actually cut my teeth during a housing market downturn in the early 1990s, and so when we saw another one this time around, I was ready for it, and I picked up a lot of building products companies and hedge funds who could take advantage of the distress, and worked on a lot of bankruptcy deals, and I like having a diverse business. I sleep better at night.
Well, it's turned out that you survived the downturn, not just survived it, obviously thrived. You have locations in how many places in the United States?
I think we're in 10 offices now, so we're pretty spread out.
I was thinking today about, you really have very knowledgeable staff, and this is a question I didn't intend to ask until just a few minutes ago. When they do research, and I'm assuming some of them do maybe original research, if they feel like they have an aha moment, how do they present that? How does that get added to the mix of things you've discovered?
Well, that's interesting. So the heart of my business and where I spend a lot of my time is on our ongoing research and our subscription business, but actually 2/3 of our revenue is what you described. It's out in the market consulting. And we have a Monday morning call where I encourage everybody to give us a quote of what you learned the prior week. And so that's probably how we disseminate what we're picking up the most interesting stuff. We also have regularly scheduled calls throughout the month to make sure we're not missing anything. And we survey a lot of our clients formally and informally, too. I lose sleep about what I don't know. So that's what I'm constantly trying to figure out is what's out there that we're missing.
You know what? That's a much safer business model for your client, too. I think the last thing you want is a consultant that knows it all.
You ever hear me say that? Put me out to pasture, Bruce.
Well, that's, it's interesting. I really respect people that have the ability to say both sides of the equation. There's usually somebody that'll be on the downside of everything. So you could always read the doom and gloom side of it. And you're in a business, and you said it very accurately, if you're a developer, there's times you make a fortune, but to get out is to keep it. And it's
right.
That's a very difficult thing to do, because usually, just as their decisions to create a fortune have to be in advance of the opportunity being obvious to everybody, exiting is probably even more important, and they have to make that decision in the teeth of almost euphoria.
You know what's the hardest part of all of this is actually the tax laws, because it's the 1031 exchange rule that no matter what you do and you sell it a lot of money, everyone seems to roll it right back in to avoid tax.
Okay. Well, I guess that's true. The only thing is, it would be advantageous is every once in a while there's a location advantage. So, you could have one area boom and the other place not. You might be able to exchange it to at least a safe haven, if not another boom. So
Maybe that's a great point. That's what I see going on today, actually, is we really changed from being a national housing market to a super hyper-local one, where some markets we've got a great outlook on and others we don't.
Well, what's interesting is you have a lot of dynamics that aren't really connected to real estate sometimes. Sometimes it's law dictated. So let's say in Florida, for instance, you have a foreclosure process that if you look at how long it's taken to foreclose on something, it's approaching 4 years.
Right.
So that changes the dynamics of what's in the market. Texas has oil. So that's a dynamic that's not always prevalent in real estate. So now, when you look at oil prices today, dip below 56 bucks, how does that affect somebody in the real estate industry in Texas?
Well, generally, it's a huge positive for the industry because it's putting a lot of extra money in the home buyer's pocket, and particularly making commuting a lot more affordable. And as you know, land is in the outlying areas, and you're trying to sell home to a commuter. So net-net, I think what's been lost in all the press is I think there's some real positives that and it should help with all the construction cost increases. In Houston, I mean, that's definitely one of those things that we still don't know. We're trying to figure out what the impact of this is going to be. There is no doubt in my mind, because I've heard it straight from some of the CEOs, that they're going to be laying people off. One of them even told me it's going to be bigger and quicker than anybody realizes. But, you know, Houston's not 100% about oil. In fact, I just looked at it this morning. If you look at all the industry sectors, it's only 2.5% of the employment in Houston. Now, there's a lot of other sectors in there that benefit from oil. I mean, a lawyer's in a different sector, for example, and he may specialize in the oil industry. So I think it's a bigger factor than that. But the question is just what kind of job losses are we going to see in Houston? We have a best guess, but I tell you that's what it is right now. It's a best guess.
When oil prices go down this fast, you know, is that something that they have analysts that were able to tell them in advance, or is this what's driving a price down like that? Is that usage declining that they didn't expect, or supply is more?
It's demand declining that they didn't expect.
Okay.
The increase, there's been a huge increase in supply, as you know, primarily through fracking.
Right.
And they've been staffing up crazy for that. And there's a lot of areas that at $80 or $90 a barrel, fracking, you can make a lot of money. But at $55 a barrel, you can't. And so they have to stop. And they borrowed a lot of money to do those activities. There's going to be a lot of distress associated with that. And I wanted to, because we went back and looked at this, oil has fluctuated a lot in the past. And in the 90s, some of the declines there didn't result in a lot of economic distress in Houston. But that's because we didn't have fracking technology and we weren't staffing up like crazy. They were just benefiting from it.
What were the years of the declines in the 90s? Because I remember the 80s, I mean, only because I got involved in buying real estate in Grand Junction, and it boomed because of not fracking, but oil shale. Same thing. But they boomed in Rifle, Colorado, and then they crashed. And so I know of that price decline. Do you remember the years of the declines in the 90s? I was trying to relate it to other real estate prices.
You know, I don't have it in
That's front. Okay. No big deal. One of the things that you had mentioned, though, and I just read an article this morning about bonds and in connection with oil. And that's where they think there could be some risk contagion there, to where there's been a lot of risky leverage associated with that. And with this price decline, that some of that could be a problem. So
yeah, that's what I've heard, too. And a lot of it's to private companies, so there's no way you can get access to the data. So we just don't know.
Okay. Some of your clients are hedge funds. So when you watch them move around the country, does that give you an idea, at least in their opinion, or is their opinion, what you've told them, that some places are priced out and others are yet to go up, as you watch where they have moved from? And go to?
You're talking about the private equity companies that are investing directly in the business?
Yes, that are actually owning rental properties. I'm sure they started, you know, they had their time in California. We'll start there. Have they basically exited as far as being the main purchaser and gone somewhere else?
Well, the big trade, and the hedge funds are more people that trade securities. The private equity ones were the ones that were playing that game. The great trade of this cycle, which I think you participated in as well, was to buy homes at a huge discount to replacement cost, knowing full well that there would eventually be upside there, or there'd be no new home construction ever. And that game played out pretty darn quickly in California and Arizona because so many people wanted to play the game.
Right.
And the disclosure laws here allowed those homes to come out of the system, and the guys who got in early made a lot of money, and the guys who got in late, frankly, didn't. And now the game is more in the judicial foreclosure states, but it's gotten more competitive there. So I don't think they're buying them at huge discounts anymore either. In fact, what is going on in that business is they're recapitalizing it. So they went out and raised a lot of entrepreneurial capital. This is a very entrepreneurial thing we're going to do, buying all these homes sight unseen. I know, Bruce, you were back in New York and you had guys throwing hundreds of millions of dollars at you to try and do this for them.
Mm-hmm.
But now they see it as more of a stable operating business. Hey, I've got thousands of homes. I've figured out how to run it and make money. The pool of capital I raised wants a 20% plus IRR. That's no longer this business. Now this is more of a steady cash flow business. So they're cashing out the 20% IRR guys and actually selling bonds on Wall Street at a low single-digit interest rates to people that want some bond income backed by a hard asset.
Now, how are those bonds doing? Is there high demand for them?
No, there's been very high demand for them.
Okay.
They've done very well.
So when there's a structure like that, and that's one of the concerns about this new player that's capable of owning several thousand homes, are they a market maker? So what's your take on that as far as while they were participating as buyers, do you feel like they were market makers in moving price?
Oh, there's no doubt. I think prices rose so much in 2012 and the first half of 2013 primarily because of them. One of the reasons we turned extremely optimistic in 2012 is because we had picked these guys up at clients, and I knew even if we had another downturn, they would just buy everything. So to me, I knew there was a floor in the market. I don't think that floor is here, at least in the West Coast anymore.
I think one of the things that happened, too, is that it wasn't just what they bought. It was that they offered on everything that they didn't buy. And so it moved the price, no matter if they bought it or not. They put pressure on the price for someone else to buy it at a different level.
Oh, I think that's true. You know, one of the things I think people don't understand, because the auction process is so unsophisticated, is how sophisticated these guys are. If you saw the computer systems and the data, and in fact, a number of them have told me there's no way they could have done this 15 years ago. But you can give somebody an address now, and the level of information that they can pull up on it, and the rental comps in the area, and the last time it was sold, and it's just they were able to do their due diligence amazingly quick and get the information out to some guy in the field as he was bidding. It's been amazing to watch.
Well, you know, we've had to compete with that model. So we've literally had to turn into that, where my son Greg is sitting at a desk and we've spent the money to create that same type of process to where he even knows who's bidding against him. We have pictures of people that bid on for different companies and we know where they buy. So literally he can pull up who's bidding against him, pull up where they own all their properties. All that goes on seamlessly while the bidding process is going on. So you're right. It's a game changer of an industry where before it used to be very few players because access to the information was pretty tedious, and now it's changed a lot. Do you view them as market makers as far as rental values being either contained or going up?
For the most part, not really. I think the rental market, I mean, they're not monopolies by any means. So I don't think they can control rents. It's a pretty competitive market out there.
Okay.
I think there's one company in particular that targeted cities. So they, you know, in that particular city, they may make the market on a single-family rental complex, just the way a landlord would make the market on an apartment complex.
Right. I think one of the main concerns is you've got multiple groups with this type of buying power that's gone from city to city and done their thing. The big concern is, are they going to make the market when they exit?
Right.
So what's your take on that, or is the exit not selling?
So their exit strategy for them, as they described it to me, was ideal because they had multiple exit strategies. We could have gone this securitization route and hold these properties forever, or frankly, we can dump them on the market. It's the easiest thing in the world to do. I own 10,000 homes, I can call 10,000 real estate agents and put them on the market. What has played out for the big institutions is that most of them have now committed to some sort of securitization where they've got a loan outstanding on these assets and investors that are expecting cash flow and leases that are often 2 years long, and it's pretty hard to sell a home with a tenant in it. So I don't think it's the big guys that we should be worrying about dumping the homes on the market. They're only a small percentage of the market, though. I think it's the mom-and-pop investors and the guy that's owned 10, 20, 30, or 100 of these who don't have that type of debt structure that I mentioned. They could just as easily wake up tomorrow and say, you know what, I think it's a great time to sell all my homes and sell them.
Okay.
And I do think during the next downturn, when everybody gets convinced that we're in one, it will exacerbate the downturn. It has to.
And what about foreign investor participation? Is it different in percentage this time?
It is, and it's been significant enough that we actually wrote a 57-page paper on it last year because I was trying to figure it out. I figured it out, but I can't predict what they're going to do. it all boils down really to one thing. It's about safety in the United States. And sure, there was distress here and there was an opportunity here, but what I learned was there were so many millionaires created around the world as all these other economies grew much faster than we did. And they wanted to get their money into a safer currency. I didn't realize this, but in a lot of countries, the title laws are not clear. You can't necessarily pass real estate on to your heirs. All those things we take for granted here in the United States, you can't do in these other countries. So I think it was the tremendous creation of affluence around the rest of the world that drove them here.
Mm-hmm.
Is that creation going to continue? I really don't know. That's the wild card for me.
How would the dynamic be different for the current buyer, let's say they be Chinese or Canadian by and large, versus the Japanese buyer of the late 80s?
Well, that's a good example. So the Japanese economy hasn't grown at all. So you saw them disappear and pull out. For the most part, actually, Bruce, I don't think they dumped their assets. I think they held on to them. but they just stopped investing, and we saw a slowdown there. I'm talking about the Japanese.
Right.
If we saw something similar happen in China, or, you know, Russia's got to be a concern now because a lot of their wealth creation was oil-driven, and they've been investing heavily on the East Coast. Could they stop? Absolutely. Would they start selling their assets in the United States? I don't know the answer to that. And I think the answer is, do they have debt on it or not?
Exactly, yeah, if they have leverage or they just have a cash. What's interesting, I happen to be speaking in Northern California in front of a group of Chinese investors, and at the Q&A, there was an interesting statement by somebody. He said, I bought a home in San Jose for $1 million. It's now worth two years later. I'm going to hold it till it's worth seven. And I thought, wow, that's pretty optimistic for one house. And yet when I inquired further, I realized he was from Beijing, and Beijing had gone up 1,000%. So it's interesting that you, and I would actually love to read what you have researched, because I think it's very valuable. You know, it's human nature to think that you're part of that success. So if somebody had 1,000% gain in China's investment in real estate and they bring it here, I think they're looking for the same return would be human nature. Maybe it's partly safety, but I think they're in their head thinking, I'm good at this and I'm going to do this again.
I'm sure there are a lot of people like that. I haven't had much one-on-one interaction with them, though.
Yeah, they're just, I don't know, but that's it. Like you say, it's interesting to try and figure this stuff out. When you were looking at the end of 2013 into 2014, how has it turned out differently, let's say, than you projected, or has it pretty much played out the way you thought it would?
No, 2014 definitely was not as strong a year as we thought it would be.
And that makes perfect sense to me. No, it does. In other words, that was a very rational conclusion. That didn't happen.
It didn't happen. So there definitely is something big out there that I don't understand. But as we modeled or estimated what was going to happen during this recovery, we looked to Houston's recovery in the mid-80s, and we looked to Southern California's recovery in the mid-90s.